Okay, now we're ready. All right, we're ready to get started. And we are in Esther tonight. I believe we're picking up in Esther chapter 8. I'm going to be a little ambitious and try to finish Esther tonight. And then Sunday, hopefully, we'll start something new. We'll probably do something New Testament. Because I guess we haven't done something New Testament in this class in forever. At least I don't think I've taught much New Testament in a while in this class. But we'll pick up in Esther chapter 8. Before we begin, let's have a word of prayer. Lord our God, our Father, our Creator, our Redeemer, we thank you, Father, that you have done so much for us, that you have redeemed us to be a people for your own possession, that you have purchased us from the earth so that we might dwell in eternity with you. We know, Father, there are times when we don't understand how you are acting in the world, and we perhaps don't see all of the little things that you are doing. But we know, Father, that you are in control, that in the end, even if we don't know what tomorrow holds, we know that you hold tomorrow. We ask, Father, that you'll help us to put our trust in you, our faithful Redeemer and Creator, and help us to not stray from your path to the right or to the left. It's in the name of Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, we pray. Amen. All right, we are in Esther chapter 8, and kind of, I don't know, it feels like the story of Esther, as you know it as a kid, kind of ended with chapter 7, with Haman getting hanged on his own gallows, and chapter 8 has some things about the Jews being saved from their enemies, and then, you know, what do you do with that? We got three more chapters in the book, although it's debatable whether chapter 10 should have been its own chapter, because it's only three verses long. Once again, we are wondering what they were doing with these chapter divisions.
I'm sure you love
that. Yeah. Well, I don't know. It kind of makes sense there, I guess. But it's just weird to have a whole chapter that's three verses long. But in Esther chapter 8, 9, and 10, we're kind of wrapping up the story, if you will. The story that doesn't mention God and yet talks about the salvation of God's people, the Jewish nation here. And in Esther chapter 8, after Haman has been hanged on his own gallows and his plot has been exposed to the king, we read Sunday morning the first couple of verses where Esther and Mordecai get all of Haman's stuff. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed what he was to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Then Esther spoke again to the king, fell at his feet, wept, and implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agagite and his plot which he had devised against the Jews. The king extended the golden scepter to Esther, so Esther arose and stood before the king. Then she said, "If it pleases the king, and if I have found favor before him, and the matter seems proper to the king, and I am pleasing in his sight, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the calamity which will befall my people? And how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred?" So King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, "Behold, I have given the house of Haman to Esther, and him they have hanged on the gallows because he had stretched out his hands against the Jews. Now you write to the Jews, as you see fit, in the king's name, seal it with the king's signet ring, and for a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked." All right, so Esther and Mordecai get all of Haman's stuff. There's that transfer of authority. We talked about that on Sunday. The king takes the signet ring from Haman, gives it to Mordecai. You know, we talked about a bunch of different ways in which that might foreshadow Jesus and the ruler of this world having his power taken away from him and given to Christ in that respect. Esther comes before the king. She falls at his feet. She begs him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. The king extends the golden scepter to her again, because we've already done this once. And she asks the king basically to write letters repealing the law. What's the problem with repealing that law?
Before we get to that,
oh,
difference in the way that you
Mm-hmm.
It says that she fell down at the king's feet. Then it says the king held out a scepter to her. Now, chronologically, it would have had to have happened the other way around. Approached the king, he would have had to held out a scepter so stories in the order of importance of these things. Not necessarily chronologically exactly 1, 2, 3 happened in that order.
Okay, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah. That's interesting.
Just something to tuck in the back of your mind.
Fell down at his feet.
Judges, the last story in Judges may not have been the last story of that time period.
Right, and it's important to realize Bible stories aren't told in chronological order necessarily. It's kind of interesting, I guess, Esther bows down to the king. Mordecai makes this big deal, I can't bow down to Haman. Doesn't explain why. A lot of people have read things into that. But one thing that we need to be careful about is buying into this idea that bowing down to somebody would have inherently constituted worshiping them, because if so, what's Esther doing here with the king, right? Either Esther's sinning or Mordecai, wasn't bowing down for that reason. Or they just have completely different understandings about what it means to bow down. But alright, so what we're looking at here, she bows down before the king, he extends the golden scepter, because I guess that's the whole business there. And we ask the king to write letters repealing the law. But there's a problem with that request. What's the problem with that request? Right, exactly. You can't change the laws of the Medes and the Persians. They're permanent, right? They make this whole big deal about it back in chapter 1. We're going to kick Vashti out. We're going to make a law that says she can't come back in. And that law can never be changed. So what's the first thing we're going to do? Well, it kind of raises this question. How ironclad is the authority of Ahasuerus' kingdom, really? And that, I think, it brings us back to the real question that the book of Esther poses. How ironclad is the authority of the kingdoms of men? In the end, how strong is it? They're all fickle. And you're going to see that as we go through the story, that, I know we can't change the laws, but we're going to change this one. Because reasons.
They didn't really change the law.
They just made another law.
But they made another law.
Effectively changing it.
Effectively created.
Right, see, that's the thing. They never say, we're going to change the law, but they find some way to do it. And this is kind of a running joke in the Bible in some ways. Like, the other book of the Bible that mentions that the laws of the Medes and the Persians cannot be changed is in the book of Daniel. And in that story, it's the same thing. They make a law. People are to be thrown to the lions if they don't bow down to the king. But then the king, as soon as that story is over, he's like, I've decided you've got to worship the God of Daniel instead. Just kind of forget that we passed that other law. And the point Daniel's making is very obvious. The kingdoms of men don't have authority over the kingdom of God. But in Esther, it's the same point, but it's more subtle. Jen? Yeah, it was a 30-day time limit. Yeah, that's true. I mean, you also had, of course, he appears to the rest of the 30 days is just kind of a wash, effectively, in that story. All right, so Esther can't endure the destruction of her people. Ahasuerus responds by saying, okay, we've given the house of Haman to Esther. Haman's been hanged, and the king has learned from his mistakes and doesn't trust anybody else with a signet ring again, and doesn't, I want to carefully oversee whatever piece of legislation you write. That's what he does, right?
He says, I messed this up, so you
think. Right, exactly. You can write whatever letter you want and seal it with the king's ring. Verse 8. And this is another comic irony in the story, because decrees written in the king's name and with a signet ring are irrevocable. And he brings it up here in verse 8. That a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked. You've got real power behind you now. I was like, but that's the same power that was behind the other decree. So what are we supposed to do about that? And in fact, Ahasuerus seems to be almost completely forgetting the fact that the first decree was also written in his name and also sealed with his ring and also done completely without his knowledge. He still doesn't see. Anything written in my name with my ring can't be changed. Except the last thing we did it with. But that one doesn't count. No, it's kind of... the fact that Ahasuerus tells them, write whatever you want and sign my name to it, calls into question whether he's... whether he's truly learned anything. He's not a character that really grows throughout the story. Yes, Mary.
Is
Yes. Yes. Yes, he was impaled on his own stake. The really, really tall one. 75 feet tall. Yeah, 75 feet. 50 cubits, 75 feet, yeah. Yeah, that happened in chapter 7. Haman gets his just desserts fed to him. How tall is this ceiling? It's 20 feet to the peak of the building?
Probably.
Okay, all right. So, yeah, oh, you. Okay, that's pretty tall. So if you stack this building on top of itself three times, you still wouldn't be tall enough, effectively, is what we're looking at. That's really... I mean, you almost kind of wonder, like, you know, all the details in the story always seem so outrageous. 127 provinces, and the king, 6-month drinking party, and the 75-foot pole, and you're just kind of like, nobody in this book does anything halfway, do they? Yeah, just about.
Well, that's 75 feet. That was built on top of over his house.
Still, I mean, that's still a pretty tall house.
That's still pretty tall.
I mean,
anyway, look at it.
No matter how slice it, I mean, you're putting.
He wants Mordecai to be seen. This is the thing.
Yeah, we got to stop. We got to exalt myself and keep. And Mordecai won't exalt me. So my response is to put Mordecai in a super high place. And we talked about some of the ironies of that earlier in chapter 5. All right, so verses 9 through 14 are basically a mirror of chapter 3, verses 12 through 15. We'll go ahead and read this. Well, the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, that is the month Sivan, on the 23rd day. It was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes of the provinces, which extended from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, to every province according to its script, and to every people according to their language, as well as to the Jews according to their script and their language. And verse 9 is your memory verse for next time. He wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's signet ring and sent letters by couriers on horses, riding on steeds sired by the royal stud. In them, the king granted the Jews who were in each and every city the right to assemble and to defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them, including children and women, and to plunder their spoil. On one day, in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, the 13th day of the 12th month, that is the month Adar, a copy of the edict to be issued as law in each and every province was published to all the people so that the Jews would be ready for this day to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers, hastened and impelled by the king's command, went out riding on the royal steeds, and the decree was given out at the citadel in Susa. All right, so those verses we just read are, you know, they repeat a lot of stuff from chapter 3 almost verbatim, but with subtle changes, well, perhaps not so subtle changes, I guess. You get the king's scribes summoned together, and they could decree to the satraps, governors, and princes in verse 9, except now the Jews are in that list as well. In verse 12, everybody gets it in their own script and language. Excuse me, verse 9, everybody gets it in their own script and language. This time the Jews are included in that. The letter is written in the king's name, sealed with a signet ring. The first letter was sent to destroy, kill, and annihilate the Jews. This letter is sent saying that the Jews can destroy, kill, and annihilate their enemies. Women and children were included in both decrees. Permission to seize plunder was included in both decrees. It's all on one day, the 13th of the 12th month of Adar, in both decrees. A copy of the edict is published in all the provinces to be ready for the day. That's said in both chapters. Couriers went out impelled by the king's command. That's said in both chapters. And the decree was issued at the citadel in Susa. That's in both chapters. I'm sorry? Adar. Oh, excuse me. Okay, so the month of Adar is the 12th month of the Jewish lunar calendar. Yeah, they had a lunar calendar, and they had 12 months, a different name. I mean, they didn't call them January, February, March, etc. They called them Nisan was the first month, Sivan was the third month, and Adar is the 12th month, which for us would be about March, well, February or March, kind of in that range. Yeah, February or March. It depends. It fluctuates because it's a lunar calendar, and sometimes the Jews threw in a leap month to keep it from fluctuating too far. As opposed to the Muslims, they have the lunar calendar that just kind of constantly goes all the way around and back. But the Jews would throw in leap months to kind of keep it resetting. Yes, Jen? Yes, correct. Sometimes Easter is in March, sometimes Easter is in April. The reason why is because it's not based on our Gregorian calendar, it's based on the Jewish calendar and when Passover is. And since Passover fluctuates between March and April, it's their first month. And you go back a month, they're in their 12th month, that's why you're in February or March for Purim and for this feast that we're talking about here. All right, verse 9, even though verse divisions don't matter, verse 9 is the longest verse in the English Bible, and it's the longest verse in the Hebrew Bible. And it's the longest verse in a lot of translations, actually. But Esther 8 and verse 9 gets that ignoble distinction. For some reason, nobody memorizes this like they memorize the shortest verses. Jesus wept and rejoice always and the second. The king's scribes get together to write the new law. They have 70 days have passed since the first decree was published. They write whenever Mordecai tells them to. Mordecai is wielding the authority over all the provinces from India to Ethiopia. Wielding authority over every language and script, and is that foreshadow Jesus? You can wonder on that. He writes it in the name of Ahasuerus. He seals it with the ring. They carry it out by royal horses, and this time the Jews have the ability to defend themselves. The letters say that the king has granted the Jews that authority to use deadly force, and by the king we mean Mordecai, even though he's not actually king, because Ahasuerus doesn't actually know what's in this letter. The Jews are permitted to assemble and kill any group of people who might attack them, women and children included. They are allowed to plunder these peoples and take their stuff, although we're going to see that that's not what actually happens. There's a lot of language from the first decree that's just regurgitated. Destroying, killing, annihilating. It's the same day. It's the same edict. And verses 15 through 17 give the resulting reversal. Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a large crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. For the Jews there was light and gladness and joy and honor in each and every province and in each and every city. Wherever the king's commandment and his decree arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. Mordecai now has... Well, what does Mordecai look like now? What's he look like? A government official. He's wearing a royal crown on his head. Huh? Hey, he kind of looks kingly, doesn't he? Yeah. Now in chapter 4, he was wearing sackcloth and ashes. Now he's wearing this robe of blue and white, and a crown of gold, a garment of fine linen and purple. And, when you really appreciate the fact that, you can't buy a $5 purple t-shirt at Walmart back then. Purple was expensive. You didn't own it unless you were a super rich person. You didn't have blue unless you were a super rich person. So it's a big deal. His glory mirrors the glory of King Ahasuerus. Everybody shouts and rejoices. You have that whole business of light and gladness and joy and honor. And it's pretty much the opposite of chapter 4, where the Jews in the provinces were fasting and weeping and wailing and laying in sackcloth and ashes. And there's a mass conversion, which is kind of interesting, in verse 17. Many of the people of the land become Jews. Why do they become Jews? They were afraid. They didn't want to die. Is Jesus foreshadowed in these verses? Is Jesus foreshadowed by these verses? Right. Again, there's this kind of this turning upside down of the kingdoms of the world, right? You got that whole business. And it's like, a foreshadow is almost a time when nations turn to Christ in response to His royal majesty. Philippians 2 talks about a time when every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. But even then, what did Jesus say right after He rose from the dead? All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go do what? Go make disciples of all the nations. Well, here they're making Jews of all the nations because Mordecai has been given authority over the empire. But that's small compared to what Jesus does. Jesus gets authority over all of heaven and earth. And they go into all that world and they make disciples of all the nations. It's not the same. Right. They believe enough to be terrified. I mean, that's an interesting point. I mean, it's interesting to me, too. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in Esther. It's kind of like, that sounds like Jesus, but it's kind of a warped version of it, almost. Like you're saying, you know, these guys are being converted out of fear, whereas, you know, the gospel, a message of peace to those who are far and to those who are near, it's, you know, there's much more involved in that, being pricked to the heart, being compelled by the love of God. I mean, there was some fear involved, perhaps, you know, people think, you know, when you hear you murder the Lord's Christ, what do you do? But then the nations start being converted, and the Gentiles start being converted too, and they're rejoicing with gladness. You know, so it's similar, but it's not. It's interesting like that. Yes, Jen? Well, it raises a... Now we have to get into a whole discussion about what do we mean when we say fear? You know, what do we mean when we say fear? I mean, because, you know, throughout the Bible, you get statement, you know, this constant call, you know, fear the Lord your God. You know, even on Mount Sinai, the voice speaks from heaven, and Moses tells the people, don't fear, the Lord has spoken to you so that you might fear Him. It's like, I mean, he makes those two statements back to back with each other, and sometimes translation obscures it by saying, well, do not be afraid, the Lord has spoken so that you may fear Him. But it's the exact same word. And it's kind of interesting that Moses states it that way. It's almost like the question is, okay, you fear God, but why do you fear God? You fear God because the volume was turned up too high? Or do you fear God for something else? You fear God because of the healthy reverence that you're supposed to have for Him. You know, and so that's kind of a question that's posed throughout the Bible. Because God says, do not be afraid to a lot of people. Do not fear. But then He also tells people to fear Him. And the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So, is fear a good thing? Is fear a bad thing? Well, it depends on why you have fear. And what you really fear. You know, so that's... I don't know, that's just kind of a two cents on that, without getting too deep into the weeds on that point. Does it kind of clarify a little bit? Yeah. Chapter 9, the Jews destroy their enemies. In the 12th month, so 9 months later, in the 12th month, that is the month Adar, on the 13th day, when the king's command and edict were about to be executed, on the day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain mastery over them, it was turned to the contrary, so that the Jews themselves gained the mastery over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could stand before them, for the dread of them had fallen on all the peoples, even all of the princes of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and those who were doing the king's business assisted the Jews, because the dread of Mordecai had fallen on them. Indeed, Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai became greater and greater. Thus the Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying, and they did what they pleased to those who hated them. At the citadel in Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. In Parshandatha, Dalpon, Aspatha, Poratha, Adalia, Aradatha, Parmastha, Arisai, Aradai, and Vizatha, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hamadatha, the Jews' enemy. But they did not lay their hands on the plunder. Okay, so that was... Right, yes, they did not lay their hands on the plunder. On that day, the number of those who were killed in the citadel in Susa was reported to the king. The king said to Queen Esther, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman at the citadel in Susa. What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, what is your petition? It shall even be granted you. And what is your further request? It shall also be done. Then said Esther, if it pleases the king, let tomorrow also be granted to the Jews who are in Susa to do according to the edict of today, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. So the king commanded that it should be done so, and an edict was issued in Susa, and Haman's 10 sons were hanged. The Jews who were in Susa assembled also on the 14th day of the month Adar and killed 300 men in Susa, but they did not lay their hands on the plunder. Now the rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces assembled to defend their lives and rid themselves of their enemies and kill 75,000 of those who hated them. But they did not lay their hands on the plunder. This was done on the 13th day of the month Adar, and on the 14th day they rested, and made it a day of feasting and rejoicing. But the Jews who were in Susa assembled on the 13th and the 14th of the same month, and they rested on the 15th day, and made it a day of feasting and rejoicing. Therefore, the Jews of the rural areas who live in the rural towns make the 14th day of the month of Adar a holiday for rejoicing and feasting and sending portions of food to one another. All right, so the day arrives, 13th day of Adar, 12th month. This was the day when the king's command would be executed, and by the king, you know, we'll put king in quotes almost, because it was really Haman's command. He was the one that wrote it, signed the king's name to it. And on that day, the Jews' enemies hoped to gain mastery over them. But instead, what happened? It was turned to the contrary. It was flipped over. It was reversed. It's almost apocalyptic. You know, you talk. One of the key characteristics when you read apocalyptic literature is this sudden reversal. The enemies are closing in. They're surrounding our city. They're surrounding our camp. They're surrounding our house. They're going to break in. They're going to kill us all. All hope is lost. And then all of a sudden, you know, God sends a lightning bolt from heaven and incinerates all of them and turns the tables on the enemies and saves the day. That's the theme of a lot of apocalyptic literature. But it's also true in Esther, which is not something you think of as apocalyptic. You know, it's like, you know, what we see in Daniel 7. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them until the Ancient of Days came. And judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the Highest One, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. You know, there's a scene in... I'm sorry? Yeah, yeah, King Ahasuerus is still alive at the end of the story. Yeah, yeah, he goes through the end of the story. We'll talk about that. You know, there's a passage in Zechariah 14 that describes a scene where all the nations surround Jerusalem and they want to plunder it, and God just suddenly flips everything around and plunders them instead. You know, I mean, you think of Revelation 17, verse 14. These will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them because He is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with Him are the called and chosen and faithful. Now, these are all passages that talk about God flipping the circumstances, changing things around, making it reversed. Here in Esther, you know, they were seeking to gain mastery over the Jews, but then it was turned to the contrary. Who turned it to the contrary? Doesn't say. We're just going to go wandering around wondering, I wonder who could have done this. It's like a big whodunit mystery. Only we've, you know, read clues in the rest of the Bible to figure it out. Well, who turned it to the contrary? God did, yeah. And so once again, we have this situation. It's like, well, how did that happen? Wouldn't have happened without the Lord. And in fact, you look at the language that's thrown out there, no one could stand before them in verse 2. That's usually God's doing. When that phrase appears in the Bible, in Joshua or in 2 Chronicles, you know, it talks about how no one will be able to stand before you because the Lord is with you. No one stood before them because the Lord was with them. Here in Esther 9, verse 2, no one could stand before them. Doesn't say why. Well, fill in the blank. You look at another phrase here. Dread fell on all the peoples because of them. Now again, when you read the rest of the Bible, what does it usually mean when dread falls on somebody, on a group of people? Yeah. How did... You know, what is, they just have a bad dream or something? Where did that dread come from? Verse 2. Yes, no one could stand before them, for the dread of them had fallen on all the people. You know, you read something like, you know, Deuteronomy 2. In Deuteronomy 2 and verse 25, when Moses is talking about Israel in the wilderness and how they fought this battle, and God makes this comment, "This day I will begin to put the dread and fear of you upon the peoples everywhere under the heavens, who, when they hear the report of you, will tremble and be in anguish because of you." God puts the dread on them so that they can win the battle. And you read the Song of the Sea in Exodus chapter 15. In Exodus 15 and verse 16, makes a comment as they're crossing the Red Sea, and the Egyptians are pursuing them, and in verse 16 it says, "Terror and dread fall upon them by the greatness of your arm. They are motionless as stone." By the greatness of your arm. So God puts dread on the Egyptians. on the Canaanites, on all the peoples they come up against. You read Esther 9 and verse 2, the dread of them had fallen on all the peoples. Well, who made it fall on them? Fill in the blank. Now, so you start seeing these little clues here, like, that was God every other time I read that phrase. Is it God here as well? The royal officials assisted the Jews in verse 3. Why did the royal officials assist the Jews in verse 3? They're scared of Mordecai. What was that? Yeah, they got the royal decree. They're afraid of Mordecai now. Mordecai has replaced Haman. Where they once feared Haman, they now fear Mordecai. You got two contradictory decrees from the king. Which one are you going to enforce? You're going to enforce the one where the guy that wrote it is dead, or are you going to enforce the one where the guy that wrote it is your boss? You know, so it kind of raises that practical question. I'm sorry? Yeah. Correct. The people that the Jews were fighting, rising up against them. I mean, it appears they don't seem to meet a lot. Like, the resistance isn't really described. It's just, you know, terror fell on them, and, you know, anybody that assembled against them, they just gathered back and struck back and killed them and plundered them. They destroy their enemies. There's not really much here about how their enemies respond to it, except, you know, chapter 8, when some of them were becoming Jews to escape this stuff. And the Jews strike all their enemies with the sword, and there's bloodshed. They do whatever they want to those who hate them. And therein raises this interesting question. You know, people have always asked, you know, is this senseless violence? Is this a holy war that God approved of, like you see with the conquest of the Canaanites? Is this a senseless slaughter that God would not have approved of? Well, the text doesn't say, and so once again, you're kind of left to think about that and contemplate on it. The Jews kill 500 men at the citadel in Susa in verse 6. And then the sons of Haman are killed and also listed by name. They weren't killed with Haman. They were executed months later on the day specified in his decree. A real final slap in the face to the dead man. Execute his sons on the day that he planned to execute your people. And the Jews did not lay their hands on the plunder, though. That expression is repeated three times in chapter 9. In verse 10, in verse 15, and in verse 16, it's repeated that they did not lay their hands on the plunder, which is very much in contrast to chapter 3 when Haman wanted to plunder them. You can defend yourselves, and they defended themselves with deadly force, right? Yeah. Right. So now Esther's... Okay, so this is where it gets interesting. The king gets the report of the number of people killed. 500 enemies, 10 sons of Haman, and all this stuff done, and the king said, well, okay, Esther, you got what you wanted. Right? No, well, what does he do? Now what do you want? I'm going to give you more stuff, right? Doesn't throw in that whole half the kingdom business, though. I mean, I guess basically effectively got that with Mordecai being in power. You know, and where last time Esther had asked for her life in chapter 7 and verse 3, this time she asks to more time to have people killed. We haven't had enough time to execute people. And also she wants the 10 sons of Haman to be impaled on stakes as well, or hanged on gallows in verse 13. If it pleases the king that tomorrow be granted to the Jews who are in Susa to do according to the edict of today, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows, or, you know, paled on the stakes. And so the king issues another edict. We're going to do all the stuff that Esther just asked. So much for that law that the king made earlier about how men are supposed to be masters in their own house. Esther seems to be writing more legislation than the king is at this point. he's just doing a lot of delegating to his wife, right? Yeah. No, but I mean, I do think there is something in the fact that the story begins with the king being all gung-ho about, you know, only, you know, men are to be masters in their house. My wife has to obey me or else. And now here at the end of the story, he's obeying his wife instead. You know, so this kind of this, you know, just does whatever, yes, dear, does whatever he does, whatever she asks without question. All right, so they have another day of killing. And this isn't even in self-defense. This is just, hey, we're going to have another day of killing. And they kill another 300 men, but they don't take the plunder. And meanwhile, verses 16 and 17 report what happened in the rest of the provinces. The Jews assembled to defend their lives and get rid of their enemies, and 75,000 people who hate them wound up dead. And they don't take the plunder either. And so this description, this explanation, kind of leads to a question about, like, what are we doing with the days here? Everywhere else in the kingdom, they do all the killing on the 13th, they rest on the 14th. But if you live in Susa, there's killing on the 13th, killing on the 14th, and then rest on the 15th. So you got two different days of rest. And why bring all that up, right? Well, the reason why is because they're explaining a ritual that is going on with Purim. And we're going to talk about that in just a moment. Yeah, would these people have fought back? The text doesn't say. I assume they would have, but... I mean, you would think they would have, but the text doesn't really talk about it. It's like, you're being attacked. You're going to fight back? Well, what's the worst that could happen? They execute me worse than it was? I really don't know. I mean, the difference in days, they make a big explanation about the difference in days here, is an explanation of how the holiday is celebrated. And, you know, the Jews in the rural towns make the 14th the holiday, whereas the Jews in the walled cities make the 15th the holiday. And that's something that actually persists to this day. You know, when Jews celebrate Purim, most of the time it's on what would have been the 14th. But if you live, like, in the area of Susa, or if you live in any other city that was considered a walled city at the time, then they celebrate it on the day after. And that's actually a Jewish ritual that still happens today. Speaking of the holiday, let's talk about Purim, verses 20 through 32. Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both far and near, obliging them to celebrate the 14th day of the month Adar and the 15th day of the same month annually, because on those days the Jews rid themselves of their enemies, and it was a month which was turned for them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and rejoicing and sending portions of food to one another and gifts to the poor. Thus the Jews undertook what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the adversary of all the Jews, had schemed against the Jews to destroy them, and had cast Pur, that is the lot, to disturb them and destroy them. But when it came to the king's attention, he commanded by letter that his wicked scheme, which he had devised upon the Jews, should return on his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore, they called these days Purim, after the name of Pur. And because of the instructions in this letter, both what they had seen in this regard and what had happened unto them, the Jews established and made a custom for themselves and for their descendants and for all those who had allied themselves with them, so that they would not fail to celebrate these 2 days according to their regulation and according to their appointed time annually. So these days were to be remembered and celebrated throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city. And these days of Purim were not to fail from the Jews or their memory fade from their descendants. Then Queen Esther, daughter of Abihail, with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm this second letter about Purim. He sent letters to all the Jews, to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus, namely words of peace and truth, to establish these days of Purim at their appointed times, just as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther had established for them, and just as they had established for themselves and for their descendants, with instructions for their times of fasting and their lamentations. The command of Esther established these customs for Purim. And it was written in the book. Right, so Mordecai sends letters to those far and near. And what we see here, of course, the obligation in those letters is to celebrate the 14th and 15th of Adar about what has happened. This is the Feast of Purim. Purim is a time where, verse 22, the Jews had rest from their enemies. I'm sorry? Purim. I'm saying Purim because, you know, Im is the normal Jewish pronunciation of that, but Purim, huh? No, it's supposed to be in, like, February or March, actually. I don't know. There might be groups that observe it at different times or something like that, but it's, you know, the 12th month of Adar would be, like, in the February or March range. Yeah, I remember he had a, you know, they celebrated it at a different time than normal. That kind of, I always wondered about that. But yes, Jen. Yeah, it's a month before Passover. It's supposed to be a month before Passover anyway. Of course, I mean, the history of Jewish calendars is convoluted and complicated, and I'm not sure I understand all of it, because at some point they started arguing for a different new year, 6 months removed from the other new year, and so it's like, you know, and then there's disagreement about, like, whether, you know, how you count certain days, whether Pentecost always falls on a Sunday, or whether it falls on, you know, whatever day. That's not consistent from calendar to calendar. Yeah, so there's all kinds of little issues like that. I'm sorry? Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know what impact that would have on it. And yeah. Yes, that's true. And, you know, it's interesting. There's a couple of things that are interesting to me about this. First of all, as far as what happened on Purim, they were supposed to spend the day feasting and rejoicing, send food to one another, and give gifts to the poor. In practice, throughout history, Purim has meant getting super drunk, is what it has meant. And, you know, rabbinic tradition argued that, you know, since everyone in the book of Esther is constantly drinking wine and banqueting, God saved the Jewish people through wine, so we're going to celebrate by drinking a bunch of wine and getting so drunk that we can't tell the difference between cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordecai. Yeah, I mean, that's in the Talmud, that statement. Although that's not the universal practice, that is a practice. Now, the reason given for the holiday, verse 24, is that Haman had schemed to destroy the Jews and kill them. But, verse 25, when it came to the king's attention, he commanded by letter that his wicked scheme, which he devised against the Jews, should return on their own head. Now, that little tidbit in verse 25 struck me as kind of interesting, because it came to the king's attention, and he decreed by letter. Well, that's not exactly what happened, because Xerxes never wrote anything, didn't send out the letter, he didn't issue the decree in writing or by letter, he just delegated the whole thing to Mordecai. And in fact, he never says any of these things at all, he just has Haman executed allegedly for assaulting the queen, if you read chapter 7. And, you know, so there's two options here that have been proposed. One is, well, we're reading the cleaned up version, which makes Xerxes look better. And the other option is, maybe we need to rethink what the text means when it says it came to the king's attention. Which king are we talking about? You know? And it looks that way. But maybe there's another king who really reversed all this. Yeah, you think about it. And it's kind of like, I mean, and it's just kind of, it seems like one of those weird little double meaning things where it's kind of like, maybe. Again, the text doesn't mention God throughout, but it's kind of like it came to the king's attention. And he issued by decree. Well, which king is it really that reversed all this? Yeah. Well, I mean, that's possible too. Yeah. I mean, you know, Ahasuerus would certainly be like him to take credit for something he had no real involvement in.
Plus, he doesn't.
Right. Now, yes. 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 And the reason for that is back in chapter 3, Haman cast the lot, that is Pur, to decide what day they were going to kill all the Jews on. Pur was the word for lot. It's not the normal word for lot. Normally the Hebrew word for lot is goral, but here they use an unusual word, Pur. And that's what happened in chapter 3. Well, the feast gets its name from that, Pur, or in this case, Purim, which is the plural of Pur. In English, when you make a word a plural, you put an S at the end of it, But in Hebrew, when you make a word a plural, you put im at the end of it. That's why so many Old Testament words have an im at the end of them, because they're really just plural forms of things. You know, like, you know, Rephaim, Nephilim, a lot of place names, a lot of, you know, various things you see. There's a lot of ims in the Bible, and that's because that's the Hebrew plural. Fun fact for the day. One other thing I thought was interesting, verse 29, this feast is established, you know, with full authority, and it's this, well, no, verse 28, I'm sorry. These days were to be remembered and celebrated throughout every generation, every family, every province, every city. They were not to fail from the Jews or their memory fade from their descendants. You know, they make it a law in the Persian Empire that the Jews are to celebrate this and they're never supposed to forget it. All right, so let me ask a question. How many laws from the Persian Empire of Ahasuerus are observed today? What? Yeah. The answer is the only law of the entire Persian Empire that's still observed today is this one. Even though Persians are long gone. So much for an empire whose laws and decrees cannot be changed. Well, one law actually wasn't changed and actually still is observed even today. Thousands of years later, people still observe the Feast of Purim. I find that interesting. It's almost like, you know, kind of a subtle jab again at, you know, that all that authority you had over 127 provinces. What meaning does that have in the end? And finally, to conclude the book very quickly, cover a whole chapter in like a minute. King Ahasuerus laid a tribute on the land and on the coastlands of the sea, and all the accomplishments of his authority and strength and the full account of the greatness of Mordecai to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? But Mordecai the Jew was second only to King Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and in favor with his many kinsmen, one who sought the good of his people, and one who spoke for the welfare of his whole nation. All right, you know that the book's going to have an exciting ending when it ends with taxes. King poses a tax on the land, which is the opposite. In chapter 2, verse 18, he's giving gifts to everybody. Here in chapter 10, he's imposing taxes on everybody. Mordecai's greatness and accomplishments are written in the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia. And you've read the rest of the Old Testament. What does verse 2 remind you of? What does that sound like? Verse 2 look familiar of chapter 10? You know, that kind of language. Where do you see that kind of talk? Yeah. Oh, well, hey, I mean, I guess that's in the New Testament. Many other things Jesus did in the presence of his disciples. But it's just kind of this recurring idea in the Old Testament is this, you know, every time you get to the end of a king's reign, it's always, and all the other stuff he did, is it not written in the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? Or is it not written in the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And all the stuff about Mordecai, is it not written in the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? And wait a second. Is Mordecai a king? Well, no, he's not. Is the house of Kish restored to kingship? Does Saul reclaim the throne? Well, no, not exactly. That's not what happened. Mordecai is second to Ahasuerus, it says. He's great, but the monarchy is not fully restored. He has favor with the people. He seeks their good. He speaks for their welfare, but that's not the end of the story. Mordecai is second in command to a pagan emperor who will likely be forgotten by said emperor's successors. Kind of like Joseph. In the end, we get a book of the Bible leaving us on a cliffhanger of sorts, leaving us longing for more. The Jews may have won a battle, but they really don't have their kingdom back. Instead of the throne of David being restored, you get a son of Kish for a major domo. Instead of the wealth of the time of Solomon, you get a tax imposed by a pagan king. Instead of the Jews being in charge, the Persians are in charge. And that buffoon of a king from chapter 1 who we made fun of, he's still king. And so Esther leaves us longing for something more. In describing all this reversal of authority and reversal of kingdoms, it still leaves us longing for the King of Kings, who will restore the people, not to their land, but to God Himself. And that is where the book of Esther ends. Any comments or questions? All right. We will pick up on Sunday with a new book of the Bible. I'm not adding new books to the Bible. We'll cover a book that's different to this class. We'll do something in the New Testament. I think we're going to do 1 John, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. I may not do them in that order, though. Huh?
You said you're writing a new book.
Oh, I'm not writing a book.
No.
But,
in your new book either?
The only book I've ever written, I don't like the chapter divisions in them. So, you know, I'll just leave it at that.